Okay, this is Victor Cannicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is May 7, 2010. The time is approximately 9:47 Eastern Standard Time. I'm accompanied by Tom Borgers and Shaista Ahmed of the FCIC, and attorneys Sharon Nels, Stephen Ross, and Megan Greer. I'm at the offices of Akin Gump for the interview of Mr. Richard Cantor. The interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Cantor. Mr. Cantor, could I get your assent on the record to that?
I consent.
Okay. Will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell your last name for the transcriptionist. I'll start with my last name is Cunicelli, C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I, Mr. Borgers.
Tom Borgers, B as in boy, O-R-G-E-R-S.
Shaista Ahmed, S-H-A-I-S-T-A, last name A-H-M-E-D.
Megan Greer, G-R-E-E-R, Megan Gump.
Stephen Ross, R-O-S-S, for Megan Gump.
Richard Cantor, C-A-N-T-O-R, Moody's.
Sharon Nellis, N-E-L-L-E-S, from Sullivan and Cromwell.
Okay, excellent. In the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute and signed into law by the President. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by 15 December 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed if you so desire, and I brought a copy today. I could email a copy to you, no problem either way.
We're fine.
Okay. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States government, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code, Section 1001, concerning false statements, a statute that has criminal liability and fines and whatnot. We talked a couple of ground rules. When we're recording, sometimes I try not to interrupt, but sometimes what I'll do, and I ask Tom to do it for me so we don't have crosstalk on the recording for the transcriptionist, is we'll just put up a finger, meaning, could we interrupt you? Could you stop for a second? So that's one thing. Anytime you mention a proper name, if you could spell it to the best of your ability. Trying to think of anything else that I usually, if a question's unclear, please, before you give a really great answer to the wrong question, just ask for clarification. Make all your responses audible so that, you know, we can't hear your head nod or whatnot. I think we're good to go with that. And just at the outset, I know there was a question about time. You're good till early afternoon or so?
Yes, it's fine.
Okay, that's great. Mr. Borgers, if you'd like to start.
Thank you. And I should say up front, we'll also say at the end, if you can keep all this confidential among your attorneys, that we really appreciate that. We ask all our witnesses to do that.
Okay.
I want to begin, and as we do with all our witnesses, could you give us a good background, take as much time as you want about your educational background and your professional background, your work history, and what responsibilities you had, especially at Moody's, but take us through the whole.
Okay, well, I won't take you to birth, but I'll start with college. I went to Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, and I went to graduate school right afterwards in economics and got a degree. Technically, they called it political economy, but it's economics, PhD in economics, and that would have been 1983. And after that, was assistant professor of economics at Ohio State University for 3 years, visiting professor of economics at UCLA for a year, and then I worked 10 years here in New York at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And since 1997, I've been working at Moody's. My capacity at Moody's, I've been an analyst following companies. We rated for about 3 years, and then for an extended period of time, 8 years, I was managing the Credit Policy Research Group, a group that reports on the performance of our ratings, and historical transitions, and defaults associated with different issuers. Also report on recovery rates on defaulted securities, and engage in analysis that can be helpful in the analysts thinking about how they should rate credits and sectors, so kind of an in-house consulting firm, consulting operation. And then in July of 2008, I became Chief Credit Officer for Moody's Investors Service. And in that capacity, I was still responsible for the Credit Policy Research Group, which is part of the credit policy function as well, but had additional responsibilities to manage the process of reviewing new methodologies and major changes to methodologies, and also serves as a additional perspective on our ratings generally, monitoring our ratings in all the various sectors, that complements the work done in the various rating groups, and also has some responsibility for providing some training services across the organization. And I've been in that capacity since July of 2008. In January or February of 2009, I got an additional responsibility to serve as Chief Risk Officer for Moody's Corporation, which takes an overview of the risks facing the firm as a whole, and tends to monitor and help conceptualize those risks and discuss those risks with management, and efforts ongoing to mitigate those risks. And we report in both cases, both on credit policy issues and on broader risk management issues, to our board of directors periodically. And I report directly to the CEO of Moody's.
Well, what I'd like to do right now is just go back to when you were hired and get in a little bit more detail about all your responsibilities, functions, and who you reported to. So when you came over in 1997, was it?
Yes.
Who approached you to come on board to Moody's? Was there more than one person?
It's kind of an interesting coincidence that I was thinking about inquiring about getting a position at Moody's, and somebody at Moody's was thinking of reaching out to me, and I am forgetting for the moment about who actually made the move, but I had a former colleague from the Federal Reserve who was working at Moody's, and one of us contacted the other, and I don't remember which, that was my entree, and then I met a number of people at Moody's.
Do you remember who that former colleague was?
Jerome Fons, F-O-N-S. And I met with a number of people at Moody's. I had a fairly broad background compared to maybe their typical analyst profile, so there were a number of areas where I might have fit in, or maybe no area because I was broad, so I spent a fair amount of time talking with different people in different areas about where might be the best match. I think I don't remember who I reported to. Yes, I do. I was hired originally formally for Andrew Silver in the structured finance group. And the reason I say it was a little unclear who I reported to is that I was working across different ratings groups on special projects for the first 6 to 9 months So I was working with the financial institutions team and with the structured finance team doing some research. And then I got to know one particular team well that had an opening, and applied and received a position in that team, which was the financial guarantor team. And in that team, I reported to Laura Levenstein, L-E-V-E-N-S-T-E-I-N, and worked in that group for the 3 years until I was...
Just a question about the... Was this the on the monolines, that portion of the guarantors, or...
Yes. Okay. The bond insurance industry, generally, yeah.
Okay, sorry.
And then around 1999 or 2000, I was asked to manage the time it was called the default research group. And it really is the same group that I was managing through 2008, which was later called the Credit Policy Research Group. But it had this ongoing function of reporting on our ratings performance and providing research on various analytical issues that might arise over time, and people would request some analytical support. And we published a lot of information available to the public about topics of interest related to ratings.
And who was part of that group?
Part of the group in terms of reporting to me or to whom I reported? Oh, okay. Wow. When I first joined that group, it was had only a few members. I think the two senior members were David Hamilton, H-A-M-I-L-T-O-N, and... Perhaps also, and I'm not exactly sure whether he left just before I came or left shortly after I came, but Sean Keenan, K-E-E-N-A-N, and there would have been some more junior people as well. I reported in that capacity to, I believe, Christopher Mahoney, M-A-H-O-N-E-Y, and that team, I mean, that reporting relationship, I think, continued until the credit policy responsibilities were taken over by a different manager than Christopher Mahoney. It was Andrew Kimball, K-I-M-B-I-L-L. I don't remember when he assumed those responsibilities. I would guess perhaps the fall of 2007, but I don't remember.
Can you tell us specifically what the credit policy group did? Do they write out a detailed policy and then get it approved? Can you give us a little bit more depth about?
Well, again, there's a credit policy group, which wasn't formed as a group until probably 2007 with Andrew Kimball.
Could I just, I thought you said K-I-M-B-I-L-L?
It's A-L-L, yeah, A-L, thank you, yes.
I just wanted to make sure we didn't have it 50 times wrong in the transcript. Thank you.
So until 2007, I guess, when I said Kimball, brought it sometime around then, there was a credit policy research team which had a fairly narrow focus, which is the team I manage, on reporting function on performance and publication. It was not wasn't involved in what might be considered the credit policies of rating practices. That was some other another activity. This is a research team. So I managed a research team, frankly, most of my years in Moody's. We did expand some of our responsibilities beyond those that I had discussed at the beginning when I took over the team, to include putting a variety of information on the desktops through computers for convenience of analysts. So one of the things we did was distribute information about quantitative information about the issuers they rate and market information about the issuers they rate. So we had a function of kind of providing some tools to analysts too. So it's research and tools. And yeah.
So would this include review and monitoring both structured finance, corporate, and can you tell us what part of the market that you were focused on?
We reported performance statistics on all parts of the market. So it was a centralized resource available to the firm to cover cover everything. When we were originally formulated, we were the reporting we were the area that provided reports on what we call the fundamental business, the non-structured finance part of the business. And the structured finance group had its own group of people that did and still do some reporting of performance statistics. In the last few years, beginning, well, not a few years, I think probably 2004, 2005, I'm really not sure when, we took on a function of saying, well, we decided to apply the same sort of reporting apparatus that we were using for our fundamental ratings to also marry them with our structured finance ratings. So we broadened the responsibilities of my group 2003, 4, 5 to also report on performance in the structured finance sector. Performance had been reported before, but we decided to, you know, centralize it since we had a lot of expertise and resource.
Could you just go through a little bit about the what types of things you would look at in evaluating performance of a structured finance deal?
Well, we would look at, you know, all the ratings that had been assigned, and we're tracking the defaults, although in the structured finance security, the definition of default is requires some explanation. It's not as simple sometimes as in corporate securities. But we try to measure the frequency and severity of investor losses for investors in structured finance securities and in corporate securities, and relate those frequencies and severities to the ratings that were assigned at different points in history to those securities, so we can calculate what the average loss experience has been for securities carrying certain ratings at different points in time, what's been the realized loss experience, and share that information both internally and with the market.
Okay, if you can continue on with your responsibilities.
So,
and who you reported to if it changes as we go through?
Yeah, no, it so when Andrew Kimball took over, my reporting line changed from Chris Mahoney to Andrew Kimball at the point he became chief credit officer of Moody's. And my function did not change, my responsibilities did not change that dramatically. I had still largely those same functions. We also began developing resource within my group to be able to provide the credit policy group, or really for Andy Kimball as chief credit officer, with resource that would allow credit policy to take an informed view of rating methodology. So we began hiring some people and doing some work providing a credit policy view on selected methodologies, because the broader role of credit policy is to review methodologies, and my group added some specialized resource that would facilitate those reviews. So under Andy Kimball, as I said, for that period of time, there was some expansion in the tasks that were being given to the Credit Policy Research Group. And then in, as I mentioned, July of 2008, Andrew Kimball was transferred to become head of structured finance, and I was asked to take on his role as acting chief credit officer. And then in January, at the time I was, I think at the same time I was made chief risk officer, I think the I was given the permanent position of chief credit officer as well.
Yeah. Could you tell us what your focus was a lot broader. It encompassed all of, you were the chief credit officer for Moody's. What would be all the responsibilities, functions that you had to do during this time period?
Well, the responsibility that I had to do, you know, that it was provide a manage a review process for new methodologies and methodology changes. That would be the primary role. I'd also have to report on Moody's ratings performance. Basically, all the responsibilities of my former team, I still inherited that. But the methodology review process and approval process was a new set of responsibilities for me. Although, as I said, my team had just begun contributing to that process, but we were just a contributor. But now I'm managing the process, and then secondarily, as chief credit officer, we also have a role in developing and effectively writing credit policies, sort of describing how the ratings process should unfold. We would contribute primarily in credit policy to introducing elements of policy that we think will strengthen the quality of the ratings that will emerge. There are other participants in the process, so we have our compliance team, we have to meet. When we have our policies, or we have many policies, but my focus was on developing policies that, you know, contribute to quality of the ratings.
During this time, was there a credit policy committee that you met with every so often to discuss any new changes, developments?
Yes, we have a credit policy committee that reviews and needs to approve major changes in methodology, new methodologies, and critical policies.
Now, prior to you taking becoming the chief credit officer, was there a committee also, a formal committee?
Yeah, the Credit Policy Committee dates back to, I would say, somewhere between, I don't know when, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was 2001, 2003. I'm not sure.
Just to get an idea who was on the committee, let's look at it in two periods. Before you took over as a participant, who was on that committee, and if you could just if you recall their names, and also whether or not they were on the business line or were they analysts.
Just to clarify, are you asking if Richard knows who was on the committee before he started participating?
Before he became chief credit officer. I thought I understood that you were part of the committee even before you became chief credit officer.
Well, I hadn't mentioned that, but it is true I was on the committee, I believe, from its early formulation as a expert, but I was contributing the information that we had from, you know, the various research efforts that we'd undertaken, and I would be a person people wanted to participate in the committee for that reason.
So if we could, I'll just throw out a date to make it easier.
Okay.
In 2005 and 2006, could you recall who was on the committee, and if you can tell us whether or not they were on the business side or were they analysts?
The question on the business side versus analysts, I'm not exactly sure what the distinction is. Moody's today has a what's called a commercial group, which deals with very specific commercial, which I would say is clearly defined as business issues, I suppose. But and then everybody else really is an analyst.
Okay, a person with a background of business as opposed to an analyst.
Oh.
You know, there are many different people, as far as I know, at Moody's on these different committees that were. Had a business background as opposed to a quantitative background.
I think part of the reason Richard is struggling is you're trying to divide the world of people into two groups that I'm not sure are either easily understood on our side or necessarily applicable to Moody's. I'd want some definite. We're going to need more definition if you're looking to label people as being in business or analytics. Because
Mr. Ross, why don't we just identify them by what group that they report to?
Yeah, that I think makes more
sense. Would that work? All right, thank you.
Your question was who was the members of the credit policy committee in 2005? I don't recall, you know, who all the members were. I can recall a few. I was a member. Jerome Fons was a member. Christopher Mahoney was a member. Brian Clarkson was a member. At one point, I don't know if he was still with the firm, someone named Mike Foley was a member around that time. Those are the names that I can recall, but I would imagine there were other participants as well.
So in 2007 and 2008, can you tell us who was on the committee at that time?
In general, the leaders of the major rating groups participate, and participants from the research side, and once we... when we establish a specific credit policy group, the leaders of the credit policy group. I don't know that the various names at different points in time could find out for you.
Do you recall who was at the meetings when you took over?
I
mean, was it Brian Clarkson at the meeting? Was it Yuri, how do you pronounce the last name? Sorry.
Yoshizawa.
Well,
when I took over the credit policy group, Brian Clarkson was no longer with the firm. Or he wasn't in his current capacity. I don't know when he actually left the firm, but he wasn't... ahead of a ratings group at that time. So he would not have been a participant. I know that at some point I at Tate took over the group, and I established my preferred membership of the credit policy group. And so at that point, I have working for me four chief credit officers, we also call them chief credit officers, but four individuals who sole function is to do the kind of work I described specifically for one rating group. So we have four major rating groups at Moody's, and I have a credit officer that's responsible for each one. So they and I are members of the credit policy group, as well as the heads of the four major rating groups. And previously we had other participants as well, and it's changed over time.
So you mentioned that you had a preferred list of people for the group when you came on board, were in charge of that group. Can you tell us who they were?
No, what I meant is I think at some point, I don't remember when, you know, I looked at my committee and I said, I want to have broad coverage of the different rating groups, because I want to have all the perspectives of those groups. I wanted my leadership credit policy, and I think initially I thought we could also benefit from a regional perspective, so I think I selected people who would represent different regions of the world perspectives. And that was what
so,
I was thinking.
So there was a change between the before you became the head of the credit area?
It's more something that, you know, periodically it changes regularly because people leave and depart, and you look at your list and you say, well, do I have this area covered or not? It's really, it wasn't a major change. I just remember just updating more. So I just remember the group of people that I brought, you know, were part of my credit policy committee. I don't remember it being a particularly unusual change. It was just sort of in the normal course of updating committee membership.
Now, during this time, could you tell us what the approval process was, if there was a change in the credit policy for Moody's in 2006 and 2007, let's say? Who had to give the approval? How did it work?
I don't know if there was any specific change. I didn't have the impression that there had been major changes. We presented major policy changes to credit committee, and we usually looked for consensus in the committee. If there was not strong consensus, people would say probably something we should reconsider, but I don't have specific items in mind. I think that just our general process has been consistent.
So, go ahead.
I wanted to just establish parameters. Help Vic Conicelli, how big was the committee roughly? I mean, you don't have to give me a hard number, but 10 to 12, 20 to 25 people?
10 to 12
people.
I would say around 10.
About 10. And you mentioned that you wanted the directors of the four major rating groups. What are the four major rating groups?
We have non-financial corporations, financial corporations, financial institutions, the public sector broadly, which we also include infrastructure finance in that. So public sector could be U.S. municipalities, could be sovereign states. And the fourth, structured finance.
Okay. And so you had the heads of all four of those rating groups. And generally, I know that there was some turnover there, but who were the heads of the four groups, you know, and if it turned over, you know, both or...
Well, these positions turned over, so
right.
I'm so I I imagine you can obtain the record. I don't know a specific date you'd like. What
we could ask it as an interrogatory, but I thought, you know, you say you took over in about 2008.
Yeah.
So
you're asking in 2008.
2008. Oh, 2008. Yeah.
Right.
Sure. I thought you were asking the whole history. Laura Levenstein was head of the public sector. Public sector and infrastructure. Andrew Kimball was head of structured finance. Michael Rowan, R-O-W-A-N, was head of non-financial corporates. And Detlef Schultz, S-C-H-O-L-Z, was head of financial institutions.
Okay. Are any of them still ahead of one of those four?
Yes. Andrew Kimball is still head of structured finance. Detlef Schultz is still head of financial institutions. Thomas Keller, K-E-L-L-E-R, has replaced Laura Levenstein as head of public finance. And Michael West, W-E-S-T, has replaced Michael Rowan.
During the 2006 and 7, were there minutes taken of these meetings, and were they passed out to the members of the committee after the
2006 and 7?
Right.
I don't know. There may have been some minutes circulated, but I don't have explicit recall of whether it was done every time or even if it was done regularly. I don't recall.
So
because I was, as I said, I was a member, but I would have participated in the committee meetings and might not have focused on it.
So you did receive minutes over this period?
I may have. If there were minutes, they would have been posted in intranet site that posts the minutes of the meeting.
Now, during your time as the head of the area, do you have minutes of the meetings, and were they passed out to the members of the committee?
As a general practice, yes. I'm not sure every meeting had minutes, but we have minutes, yes.
Is it possible for us to get a copy of those minutes? I don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
I wanted to bring you back to a little bit more about your history. When you arrived in 1997, Moody's was part of a larger company. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us how, from 1997 until the spinoff of 2000, was the environment different? Can you tell us a little bit about that time period?
Was it different between 97 and 2001?
Well, in comparison to from 2000 on, you know, can you tell us what was the how you looked at the
what Mr. Borders, Vic Canicelli, is trying to really artfully say is that in the media much has been made of this, you know, pre-2000 Moody's is a private company. Very stodgy, staid, academic. Post-2000, they're spun off, they're private, and now they behave like everything's up to date in Kansas City. You know, it's a money-making enterprise. And we just wanted you to comment on that. Was there a different culture? You were here prior to 2000. You were here post-2000. Mr. Ross, you had something.
Yeah, I just, because you're recording and you're mm-hmm. creating a transcript, I think your question said that after 2000, Moody's was private. I think he's private both in the pre and post-2000, and I know you're concerned about your record.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the clarification, for the correction.
You know, in my experience, the culture at Moody's has been consistent throughout my career.
In 2000, or prior to 2000, what was the percentage of the market share did you have for, let's say, the RMBS side of the market? Do you recall?
I don't know that.
Was it 15%? Was it 50%?
If I could just sort of ask for some clarification, people have used the term market share, and there have been a number of discussions of this, because it doesn't apply in the traditional sense, because very often a issuance will have more than one rating, and whether it's a better term to use of market coverage rather than market share. But as long as I'd like to see if we could have some understanding, because there ends up being some confusion, because it ends up being over 100%.
Right. Were you smaller in your market coverage than S&P in 2000?
I don't know.
After 2000, was there a significant drive for market share?
I mean, maybe I should just take a step back here and explain that I was an analyst, and I was in the research area, and I'm in a ratings group, and these would not be topics that I spent a lot of time thinking about at the time. So to the extent I had any knowledge of this topic, it would come from some media source, or if I happened to glance at some annual report or some, it wouldn't be something I would have any real knowledge about, other than a superficial one that one might gain through public sources.
So during after the spinoff, there among the analysts, was there a more drive to? Did you increase business after 2000?
Wasn't my experience that there was any change in our practices, other than additional reporting, public reporting requirements, and all the things that a public company has to do. The only change was around some additional personnel that had to be hired to do public filings and deal with. You know, I was aware that there are some things public companies do that are different private companies to do. All that was sort of in the corporate office. But in terms of the ratings business, everything was the same.
Well, what I'm asking is, during this period of 2000-2001, was there a substantial increase in the number of deals that the analysts had received a successful bid on?
I don't understand the language about successful bids, but the volume of activity,
right,
at Moody's, generally speaking, varies with the activity in the market as a whole. And so any particular year you cite, it wouldn't matter which one. If it was a year where the markets were very active, Moody's would probably be very active. And if the markets were relatively slow, activity might be slower at Moody's. That's almost exclusively the main driver of activity at Moody's, is market activity.
So as far as the number of deals that a particular that Moody's had booked during this period in 2000-2001, was S&P substantially larger in the amount of issues that they reviewed?
Okay. First of all, the language of deals booked and things is not a kind of.
Okay.
Let me just say, just in terms of the activity and the rating activity at Moody's, I don't know. I have any idea about the level of our activity relative to other participants in the market. I imagine most participants' activities went up and down with overall level of market activity, but the specific comparisons, I don't know anything about what other agencies were doing, rating agencies were doing.
During this period, did you ever speak to other analysts outside your own area?
Yes.
Did you ever speak about the volume of issues that they were reviewing? And
only to the extent you'd talk to someone and say, how are things going? And they might say, things are, I'm very busy. And that's about the extent, or things occasionally not so busy. But that would be the extent of it.
Also, during this period, we've heard that there were a number of analysts that were fired. I think it was covered in the media pretty well back then, or over the years, that there were about 22 analysts that were fired during this period between 2000 and 2001. Do you recall reading anything about that or hearing anything about that within the analysts that you're, you've been connected with?
Between the period of 2000 and 2001, I don't recall ever even reading anything about that. I'm certainly not aware of anything about it.
Okay. So from 2001 on, do you believe Moody's was substantially increasing its number of issues it's reviewing?
We were a growing firm, so we rated a lot more corporates, financial institutions, structured finance securities, public finance securities. Well, really, since we've been growing rapidly since mid-70s.
So one of your functions was to review the deals that your response, or the issues that you were following. Was the number of issues that you were following over these years increasing substantially? And could you give us a rough idea of how they increased from 2000 on?
Well, the reviews that we did is on the entire outstanding stock of things that we rate. So we don't focus particularly on the flow, which would be new issues rated, because the stock is new issues rated minus issues retired. So what my analysts focus on in their analysis is the stock of ratings outstanding, grew in all sectors where we rate over time, in the U.S., internationally, in all lines of all different ratings groups. What percentage increase?
Well, could you give us a rough idea of the number of issues that you were following? Was it 100? Was it 1,000? Was it 10,000?
There's two ways you can analyze ratings. One is at the level of the bond issue and how many bond issues there are. And you can, in the case of corporates and public institutions, focus on the issuer that may have many bond issues outstanding. And for much of our work, we focus on the issuer level rating. So we would have, for example, maybe 6,000 financial and non-financial corporate issuers worldwide, but they would have hundreds of thousands of issues. And in the public finance sector in the U.S. alone, we would have maybe almost 18,000 issuers with what could be described as individual securities totaling a million or so. And in the structured finance area, you don't have the concept of an issuer, because structured finance well, a structured finance security is typically originated, it's typically issued by a special purpose vehicle just for the purpose of issuing that security. There may be multiple issues by that vehicle, but typically they carry different ratings and they're related. But there's a handful of them. They're all done usually at the same time, so there might be 5 or 10. But they're viewed. But collectively, all the issues in structured finance might be 80,000 issues.
So breaking it down a little finer as far as RMBS CDO reviews, can you give us an idea of how it grew over these years? Let's say, and you know, it doesn't have to be exact. You know, an approximate indication of how it grew.
The stock of outstanding issues would probably have grown. I don't really know. But if you told me it was 10 or 20% a year or something like that, it wouldn't surprise me.
In 2000, let's throw out a number. Do you have a rough number of for just RMBS and CDOs? What you're covering, monitoring at that time, and versus 2006-07.
I don't know what the difference would be.
So, do you have any idea of
not
how
really.
Many issues you were following?
Well, as I said, we weren't. My group. First of all, we weren't following it in 2000. My group began following ratings performance, in 2003, 4, or 5. I don't remember exactly when, so I wasn't particularly focused on the size of the market in 2000. But we have reports where the numbers are there. I just don't know offhand what the number of outstanding securities were at different dates.
There's got to be a more efficient way to get, if that's information you're interested in, there's an easier and more efficient way to provide that to you.
I'm just trying to get a general idea of whether or not it grew substantially from early, let's say 2003, 4 when you were to 2006 and 2007.
Well, Moody's has been a growing firm for decades, so. I don't know, substantially. We were in the financial services sector, and the financial services sector has been a growing industry until recently, for quite some time.
Are you aware of any of let me regroup on that. Were there any warning signs in the market that you were seeing, especially on the subprime side? Could you tell us roughly what year you were started to develop concerns about the subprime and related products?
Well, Moody's is always noting and thinking about concerns in all markets, so. It's a kind of open-ended question in the sense that we're always, every report we issue, we discuss concerns. And we have a series of comments on the mortgage market that go back many years, and one can track what was being said at different years, and various concerns are always being expressed. In terms of leading into the crisis, and what in particular, say in the subprime market, was our views and communications. In beginning, I think in 2003, and then continuing every year, I know we have. I've looked back. I wasn't directly involved. I've looked back and read our reports, and see, statements that some of the mortgage pools were of lower underwriting quality than in previous years, and I saw some statements that housing price appreciation had been rapid in, say, the previous year, and that was a trend we wouldn't expect to continue, and therefore performance, which had been highly unusually healthy performance in this market, we didn't expect that level of zero, virtually zero losses on subprime mortgages and collateral pools to continue. So there was a recognition that the future was going to have. So there were two things. We recognized some lowering in underwriting standards in the collateral pools that we were reviewing, and that the future of performance of mortgage collateral pools in general, even holding their characteristics constant, would expect it to be weaker than it had been in the past. And over that time period, the criteria for reaching different rating levels in a mortgage-backed security changed over time to reflect those views.
So when specifically for you were there concerns developing in the subprime market? What year was that?
For me personally? Yeah. For me personally, would have been 2007, because that would be the first occasion I had to, I think it was 2007 to be asked, the first time it came up for me.
Just to make certain that I understand this, so the first time you had concerns about the subprime market was 2007, personally?
Well, okay, let me take a step back. When I joined Moody's in 1997 from the Federal Reserve, both the Federal Reserve and Moody's were very concerned about the subprime market in 1996 and 1997. There were what were called 125% LTV loans being made, and they were somewhat new, and people were concerned, and Moody's had expressed concern. But see, we express concern we're natural worriers, so we're always expressing concern. So I've always, at a distance, kind of been aware of many of the concerns in press and in Moody's and in regulatory agencies, and bank supervisors issue concern letters on a regular basis on almost any topic. I was somewhat knowledgeable, recognized that there has been concerns expressed in the late 90s about mortgage markets, and then continuously people always talk about concerns. But in terms of going back and reading our research in a systematic way, I began to do that in 2007, because in 2007 Moody's was reaching out to other areas of the firm for perspective, and I was asked to look at various a variety of things, being sort of in a research group, and so that's when I particularly remember going back and kind of reading all the things we published on it.
Along these lines, was there a subprime committee throughout Moody's that was looking at the potential problems in the subprime market?
I don't know of anything called a subprime committee. I would say that the focus of analysts in any sector, so to the extent we had analysts dedicated to rating mortgage-backed securities, there would be a group of people that were constantly thinking about credit issues in that sector.
So there was no subprime committee that you were on the committee to review the subprime crisis?
Well, there's a After. I thought you were talking about during the.
Well, in 2007 and 8, wasn't there a subprime committee that you were part of?
Oh, I think there was a. Oh, I you may be referring to subprime working group.
Okay.
Okay. And that was a group that we were, you know, we were beginning, you know, that this is the beginning of the crisis. And that was, so that's why I say in 2007, there was a recognition that the market was changing rapidly and we needed to, as a firm, typically most, if there's a problem in the oil and gas industry, you know, it's handled, you know, everything can be best handled by the team that follows oil and gas. But when, you know, issues, you know, a crisis is developing in a market, we wanted to bring, you know, multiple people's perspective on both the research we're doing, communications. A lot of it was focused on communications and making and trying to make sure different, since there were these ripple effects from the mortgage market to other parts of the firm, to make sure everybody knew what, you know, what our firm's view, you know, or make sure everybody was talking to each other.
Did the subprime group, now is that the term that you used? Did the subprime group, how often did they meet, and who were
I think the primary focus of that group was around communications, to make sure everyone internally you know, were understanding what we're saying, because different rating groups it was really for exchange of information, it wasn't a deliberative body with respect to ratings criteria or policies or anything to do with that. It was really a communications group, and at some point we didn't really meet for a very long period of time. It really just became kind of an email box. You know, you say, oh, here's all the people that might be interested in what we're publishing tomorrow on the latest delinquency numbers. And so it was almost an email blast, basically, to all the potentially interested parties. So that was how I think of that group. It was kind of a communications email box.
And just so if I may, so the record's clear, I think you said, but I think it's also correct, it's not subprime group, but with the subprime working group.
Right, right. You're Ms. Nels, right?
Yes.
Okay. Just to follow up for one second on that, it's Vic Conicelli. When you say it was largely communications, largely internal communications, or was it internal and external, you know, let's get all the right people talking and let's get information around inside Moody's, but let's also have a common message externally, or was it just internal?
It was both. It could be a common message where you wouldn't want to say conflicting things unless we had conflicting views that we wanted to communicate, so it would be a common message. But I think some of it's also, it was a big organization, and we have a lot of independence. So publications come out from different groups, and the market thinks everything is, you know, there's like one person at Moody's doing everything. And in fact, it's really very different from that. There are many outlets of information, and you know, we could get calls about things we publish for comment, and we're not even aware that various groups have published it. So it's that kind of communication, heads up.
But there was one person at Moody's, Mark Zandi. Sometimes it seems like Mark Zandi is moody.
If I may, just be very clear about this. Mark Zandi is not a member of the rating agency, and so it's actually, I don't think, you need to be very careful.
I apologize.
But I think it's a great illustration. Because Mark Zandi doesn't work at Moody's Investor Service and doesn't speak in any way for Moody's Investor Service, and yet my colleagues will get questions about what Mark Zandi has said on various topics.
Guess that was my point sometimes, that sometimes he's like the voice of Moody's to people externally sometimes. That's why I was asking. I'm sorry.
On the street in Kansas.
Yeah. That's why I wanted to be sure. It sounded for a moment when you were saying, getting people talking and whatnot, that it was just internal, but it was both. It was mm-hmm. internal and external messaging.
Getting back to the subprime crisis and this informal group, whatever, was Ray McDaniel involved in that interest in this group and its information? Did he send you emails about his interest in what you were talking about, what you were discussing, if you were putting out any reports?
Yes.
Could you give us some indication of were there any findings? Did you have any formal findings other than information sharing? Was there any collective analysis of what all these different groups were seeing? And was there ever a paper prepared or papers prepared?
Well, this wasn't a group that was deliberative about credit issues, so about how we were, anything to do with the ratings process. In terms of our external communications, our Moody's practice has always been to get a lot of commentary from everybody we can in the corporation who might have insight and views for clarity of communication. So this group would have commented on people's public communications on various subjects. I'm not sure what you're referring to.
It
didn't have a work product of its own, is my understanding. I don't think of it as having had any particular work products. So it was really a formalization, not even formalization. We always send out interesting commentary that we're writing to our colleagues for comments. We've always done that. And as a universe of interested and people with multiple perspectives grew on subprime at the beginning, we created this list. So it's just it was rather than having to type out a lot of names in an email chain, we created an inbox so that everybody
to help us focus on what you would share information on. Did the subprime issues come up about CDOs and its impact upon the CDO ratings? Did you share information about that?
Well, we wouldn't have communicated to such a broad audience, specific ratings decisions or criteria. It was not a ratings management kind of or anything. That there's a whole ratings process that's very that has its own life in it. This was a communications inbox, as I said, for comments. Just reaching out to your colleagues for comments, as I recall. So you asked something whether there was ever comments about the CDO market. I would imagine so.
Let's focus on some specific dates then. I'm trying to get an understanding of what's developing in Moody's at this time of, let's say, July 2007. In July 2007, I recall that there's about 399 issues that were downgraded. Can you tell us something about what was happening in Moody's at this time, and were you involved in speaking to other analysts of what this all means and the implications of this? Can you walk us through all the different information groups and give us some good background?
Well, as I recall, Moody's had taken selective actions and communications on about what our perspective was on subprime, particularly beginning November 2006. And sometime before that July announcement, I don't know how much time before, I would guess weeks, but there was a review of transactions, but I wasn't involved in anything to do with the analytics of those reviews. Sometime before the announcement of those rating actions, my guess would be a week or two, but I don't know for sure. I was asked if I could provide a broader context to what we were seeing in the subprime market in our upcoming teleconference, where we would be discussing the rating action. And I... and with partly as my background, both knowledge of the historical movements of our ratings in different sectors over time, and in part because of my background as an economist with some macroeconomic training and experience as well, because this was largely a macroeconomic phenomenon in contrast to most of the things we deal with in day-to-day, which are... very kind of idiosyncratic, affecting individual transactions or issuers. So I provided my thoughts on kind of just providing perspective on why it might be that we were seeing a large group of downgrades across a sector of securities at the same time.
Could you give us a summary of what your thoughts were at this time?
My thoughts were that while in the long history of the structured finance market, where we've had lots of rating changes, in most cases those rating changes were limited to a particular transaction or maybe a series of transactions of an individual sponsor, because they reflected differential performance, good or bad. Sometimes we upgrade a lot of securities and it's downgraded, so different performance that we didn't expect at the time we assigned the original ratings, but we knew might happen, and as that performance deviated from our initial expectations, we would adjust the ratings up or down. Usually that, in most cases, those rating changes reflected developments that were specific to an individual collateral pool or maybe a series of collateral pools that had similar features of the same sponsor. On occasion, on two occasions that I can recall, the unexpected developments were very broad to a sector, so that most of the securities in the sector had similar downward rating transitions. What we were seeing in subprime was that this was one of those events where you see a sector being generically affected. Each individual transaction is experiencing a different specific impact, but we could see the unexpected activity was broad. And I was noting that unlike most transitions in ratings, this was one that was going to affect a sector. We've experienced that before in a couple other sectors, and it's endemic it's endemic that a sector in structured finance. I was also thinking through why in structured finance, the possibility that many securities would be similarly affected at once is greater than you might have, say, in the corporate environment, although it's still true in the corporate environment. In fact, we discovered it in a very significant way with financial institutions recently. But at the time, I was focused on the fact that risk is has a stronger idiosyncratic element in corporate, and in some structured securities, there could be a shock that affects similar securities in similar ways. And so I was developing my thoughts around that vulnerability in structured finance, and how what we were seeing in those July downgrades was a recognition that that a sector, you know, as a whole, might experience a similar transition.
So were you deeply concerned? Were you somewhat concerned? Were you moderately concerned? Could you tell us how concerned?
Not sure. Concern. I don't know if.
Let's just use risk types of terms. Did you think it was a low risk? Did you think it was a moderate risk? Do you think it was a high risk?
I didn't do any analysis of the mortgage market.
But to focus on these downgrades and what's happening in the subprime in July of 2007,
right?
Were your concerns high, medium, or low?
Again, I don't know what you mean by concern. Let me just tell you what my thinking was. Moody's was announcing rating actions that was going to interest many market participants. And my role and my concern was to provide a good framework for thinking about them and putting them into some perspective. That was my concern.
So let's focus on some of the other people that you had discussions during this period with, other analysts, other members of Moody's, about what was happening in July of 2000 in the market on the subprime RMBS and the related market CDOs and so on, related products. Can you tell us their views? Did they share a similar view as yours, or? And can you remember having any? Who were you having discussions with about this?
Well, as I say, I prepared remarks for the teleconference and shared those remarks with a large number of colleagues, and I generally recall people were receptive to my way of framing the discussion, and so I have to assume from that we had similar views.
Was there anyone at Moody's at this time in July that was seriously concerned about the market in July of 2007?
Okay, again, it's a suit concern. At Moody's, people are all concerned at all times, and so I don't know what everybody's seriously concerned at all times.
I'm not a quantitative person, but I'm a banker. Did anyone foresee that there could be a collapse in the subprime market of 10 to 15%, 20 to 30%, 50% or more? Is that?
Well, percent of what? I'm not even sure.
Percent of, let's say, a default rate. Was anyone at Moody's considering that there could be a dramatic increase in default rates in the subprime in July of 2007?
Well, first of all, I would not know what anybody was thinking at Moody's, but the downgrades that we took and the communications that we've been making through this period and at the time of those downgrades were expressing a heightened concern about the performance of subprime. I don't know the extent. I wasn't involved in discussion of the analysis of you know how bad things might get and the probabilities on that. The fact that we took a view that a large number of securities that were rated at one level and we were rating them another level meant that we thought the risk of those securities as a group of actually experiencing losses had increased. We always view any security as at risk that it could lose. So then what was the thought that was becoming more, you know, in my mind was that the risk was a very highly correlated risk. The risk, I don't know whether it was small. At the time, I didn't know whether it was a small risk or a large risk. I didn't have a particular view on that. But what I was focused on was thinking, you know, from what I was hearing, that there were many similar transactions in the market, so that whether the probability was high or small, it had very significant implications, you know, for a broader group than we normally experience when you're just talking about one security.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, using real numbers, did you hear during this time frame of what some of your colleagues were talking about as far as the range of defaults that could be happening in the subprime market and Alt-A market?
At that time, I did not have any conversations that I can recall or read anything about specific projections of defaults. And it may be just that I wasn't focused on it because it wasn't my job at that time. But I don't recall particularly having conversations at that time about projected defaults. We probably discussed it in our teleconference because that was the person's job who was the expert in there, probably discussed it explicitly. But, you know, I had my part of the presentation. I was very focused on my part and where I was expert. But I don't remember what was in that.
Well, do you remember who was responsible for following, monitoring the defaults?
Well, I know I don't know exactly the organizational structure that group had. There are probably many people responsible. Nicholas Vail, W-E-I-L-L, was a speaker on our teleconference, and I believe he was involved in surveillance of mortgage-backed securities. So he was not just a speaker, but he was substantively involved. So he'd be the one person that I'm aware of was involved.
And so you don't recall what if he said anything about specific numbers or?
Boy, I don't remember the specific numbers.
Now, prior to this downgrade in July, there were several, earlier in July, there were several new issues coming out. Do you recall any discussions about that?
No.
Now, with these downgrades in July, the 399, how many weeks do you think did they come up with this idea about the downgrades or these concerns about the downgrades over a month, over 2 months? Were there any discussions about that? How quickly were they reacting at this time to the changes in the market?
I wasn't involved. I don't know anything about it. The only thing I know about our prior considerations in mortgage-backed securities from our published research, which I had subsequent experience to go back and read a fair amount of it, and I believe we had some congressional testimony on the subject in April of 2007.
In speaking to the analysts who were responsible for these downgrades, did you speak to any of the analysts responsible for these downgrades?
Well, I'd say it's committee process would have been used to take rating actions as it always is. And as I said, I may have spoken to Nicholas Vale about something prior to the teleconference about the setup in the room, but other than that, I don't think I engaged in substantive discussions on the mortgage. I don't think I did, but I may be wrong. Until after this, I thought it was called in. It was, as I recall, it was kind of, I was called in and to, you know, prior to this conference to provide the macroeconomist perspective on and the kind of rating performance perspective on these rating actions.
Now, in January 2008, there were many, many more downgrades. Do you recall that time period? There were hundreds and thousands of downgrades.
Yeah, I'll be honest, the last few years have been, there's a lot going on, and so, I've been financial institutions and everything, so I just preface by saying, you know, a particular month or anything, I really would not be able to say with certainty that almost anything happened on a particular
month. Well, this was the largest downgrade in the history of Moody's, in the history of the structured finance markets. Do you recall the meetings that you had with others, or did you have any meetings about this serious or, let's say, numerous downgrades? Was there any discussion that you participated in?
Well, after July 07, I don't remember the date, but I think probably when Andy Kimball became chief credit officer, from then on, when we had, while he was chief credit officer, I think we occasionally would have meetings to review our perspective on developments in the mortgage market, and I don't know if I attended all of them, but I remember I was attended those meetings.
Well, can you tell us some information that was being shared among your associates, colleagues, about the concerns of the market? And
right. So
spend as much time as
sure.
you want about what's going on.
Well, as I say, I don't remember how many meetings there were, but in general, we established a process where we would periodically meet to discuss what was going on in the market, and the primary focus of that discussion would be an analysis presented by our surveillance analysts in that sector of what they were seeing and what the kind of aggregate delinquency numbers were in different vintages, and they'd break it down by other dimensions as well, but they'd give us a picture of what we're seeing. We'd also read or consider commentary from any source outside the firm as well, and the ultimate objective of a few of these meetings was to take a view on where we thought expected collateral pool losses, mortgage losses, were going, and take in the aggregate for different vintages, for different years of origination of the collateral. And we take a view, and once we agreed on that view, we would think about two things. One, well, the primary thing was we'd also think about how we would communicate that view to the market explain how we reached that conclusion. And secondarily, that was a view about the aggregate market. That didn't really tell you what to do with individual securities, that would be a first step in a process to kind of move that new assumption to the surveillance group, who then had some other process for taking how do I use my aggregate view and marry that with the information we have on individual securities to take rating actions if need be on individual securities. And so I was not really involved in the next step. So at the high, I was involved in this sort of high level overview of the market discussions, and a couple of times some of the communications around it to figure out how to, you know, best characterize what the substance of our discussions and the analysis and how we reached our conclusion. So I was involved early on. I think that process probably continued on without me at some point because it became more you know, regular for these updates, and it, you know, what we were going to do was not as unclear, but it was something, we were facing something new in the first couple of meetings, really new, and so we had more people participate.
Can you tell us what your specific personal concerns were about the how the market was developing in the subprime and Alt A especially?
Well, delinquency rates were coming in higher than we had expected, and we were aware beyond the delinquency data, we were aware that refinancing opportunities had, we've been told, I mean, I didn't have firsthand knowledge, but refinancing opportunities had disappeared for most borrowers in this part of the market, and that prices were beginning to drop very rapidly, in not just in the few, you know, in some of the regions that we had known were dropping going into the crisis, but in across, almost across the nation. So we were getting market information about home prices and market activity and refinancing availability, and we were looking at the delinquency numbers, and we knew that things were changing, and we didn't know how much. There was wide variations in opinions in terms of, we didn't just look inside, we looked outside the firm to see what the other people were saying, try to understand not just what they were saying, but if, you know, did they have a logical basis that, you know, or empirical basis for what they're saying? Were they just assertions? You know, what was it based on? So we would gather that information, and we would try to reach a conclusion.
As you went into your new roles as the chief credit officer and also chief risk officer, did you, after the crisis, fully developed, did you do any studies about on the market, how any postmortems on what had happened
on the mortgage market? We didn't do an explicit study. I don't recall a study.
So you didn't do any studies in your group at all concerning what the lessons learned, you know, from the mortgage crisis?
Well, when I say a study, I was thinking of an empirically based study. I mean, we certainly have given a lot of thought to lessons learned, and we've had a lot of discussions and probably bounced things back and forth in communications and some of the things we've put into our publications. So, you know, a study of, it's one event, so to study an event doesn't often take, there isn't like a deep empirical study necessarily required to pull out to try to draw your observations. Since it's one event, and hundreds of explanations are available, you won't be able to prove anything with a study either about what caused the event, because it's one event. So it's an empirical study. You need thousands of such events and alternative hypotheses to be tested. But you observe something and you think logically about what happened and what, you know, to the extent you have a common view, you can come to some common lessons learned and practices, changes in practices or thinking going forward to, you know, try to reduce the risk of not seeing something coming up like this again in the future.
Well, let's spend some time on, and you could take as much time as you like, to go through the lessons learned that that your ideas, your analysis, and also of your colleagues.
Yeah, let me just suggest, is this a reasonable time to take a quick break?
I think so, absolutely, yeah. If you like. Let me, it's 11:23, we'll go off record. Okay, the time is approximately 11:29, and we're back on record. Mr. Borchers?
Thank you. Thank you all. Wanted to spend a little bit of time reviewing some modeling questions, and my associate will start with some of those modeling questions, and we'll jump back to some other questions later.
Well, I just first want to step back a little bit. The Credit Policy Research Group, I just want to get like an idea of how big was the group in the background? I know you're an economist, and so were there any other economists within the group? Or
Yes. Again, it matters what time period, because it was a group expanded over time. But in, I don't know, maybe you're interested in 05, 06?
Mm-hmm. And you were right there in 2000.
The Credit Policy Research Group was around 2000.
Yeah. And what was your title? I forget. You mentioned this, I'm sure.
I forget. I had some maybe senior vice president title, and then after 6 months, I think I became managing director. And I was had managing director title through 2008. So, before the crisis, as I said, when we were focused on providing general analytical research, ratings performance, and putting quantitative tools on the desktops of analysts, I probably had five kind of very senior independent researchers working with me, four to five. And they would have PhDs. I think I had one in statistics, one in finance, one in two in economics, or two in something like that. Yeah. And maybe five other people of different with different backgrounds supporting.
So it's around roughly 10.
Yeah, a group of like 10.
And that was the range from 2000 to 2008 round.
It started off at 4, and it grew to be 10.
So I guess your group had a particular knowledge of the methodology underpinning the ratings.
No. We weren't involved in methodologies. We began looking at methodologies in 2008 under, you know, as I said, when Andy Kimball became chief credit officer, decided to task the credit policy, well, the credit policy group as a whole, as he developed the mandate for the group, included a review of methodologies, and the primary people responsible for reviewing the methodologies would be the chief credit officers, as it is today under me. They're the lead. They have the broad experience with the sectors that are being rated, to the extent that they're interested in issues, or there's modeling issues or empirical data issues, that's something that as an analyst you don't have easy access to or may not have in-depth knowledge of, they would look to members of the credit policy research team to provide analytical support. So it's a consulting tool or support area to help the work of the chief credit officers of the different rating groups and myself in reviewing methodology.
So prior to 2008, it was mainly chiefly the chief risk of the officer that was partaking in the review of the methodology and his group, not so much the credit policy group. Just
again, the ratings groups are responsible for their methodologies. They develop methodologies. They provide any analytical support that might be there may be for the methodology. They're responsible for the ratings and the methodologies. These are our ratings analysts. They are the core. We have over time found it useful to put in place people who are not focused on a specific portfolio of credits, but to have a broad mandate across all the sectors within a broad ratings group, and we've called them credit officers or chief credit officers, who would review a lot of the analytical activities that were going on for consistency in approach, and for, you know, just kind of somebody with an overview that didn't have to get involved with managing the details of specific portfolios. So we had credit officers that would support the consistency efforts and the quality efforts of the ratings teams that were more focused on narrow segments. And the need and desire to have credit officers probably grew over time as our rating groups grew, and the range of issues that would come up, and geographical regions. So we developed over time credit officers who serve this role. The review function of methodologies was really still a broad committee process, although it may be that many years ago methodologies were just developed by a ratings group, and I don't know the approval probably really just predates me. When we developed a credit policy group, which is different from the credit policy research team, which always existed and had a kind of, you know, was not involved in methodology, but the credit policy group was had some additional headcount that it was given, but to a substantial extent, we chose to pull in some of the credit officers that were in the rating groups, or maybe different people, or sometimes same people, different people. But the idea was, you know, maybe these people that are serving this kind of broad overview of rating policies within a group and methodology consistency, maybe it'd be better organizationally structured in a centralized group. So we've developed a centralized group. And in most organizations, there's a pull between two different models. One is kind of a decentralized model and a centralized model. And we decided to pull towards the more centralized model for the credit policy function and create a credit policy group where the credit officers of different sectors really work together. So my financial institutions and so on, a person works with the non-financial and me and so on. So which one of our big efforts to enhance our analysis going forward is to share a lot of insights across sectors. So we thought it would be very valuable to bring this group together to share insights, even though they also go back out and review one sector. They're each responsible for one sector, but they also work together to share insights. And the other reason was to create a very clear, very independent, separate credit policy group that would reflect in its organizational structure the approach that we take in credit policy generally anyway, and to kind of replicate it in the organizational structure of this independent review complementing the work that's done in the ratings group side by side.
Interesting. I know maybe you can't get into the weeds of it, but I'm really just interested in, from a more nerdy perspective, understanding how the RIDS ratings, what are the main ingredients of it, and the various methodologies over time. I mean, I know you may not know the specific specific changes and revisions to the methodology, but maybe you know the phasing over. I know initially, if we could just look focused to the RMBS, I initially, like, prior to the M3, I think that's what it's a colloquial term, there was a benchmark approach to rating RMBS. Were you familiar with that? If you could expand on how it was conducted, like, what was the methodology, what was involved, what were the main ingredients?
I don't know the benchmarking approach. I don't know how mortgage-backed securities were rated specifically in the past. I can tell you how structured finance securities are rated generally, and you know, there's usually, I mean, there's a wide range of considerations that go into structured finance, and in some cases, there may be a model used for some guidance in terms of thinking about the potential risks of losses in the collateral pool that underlies the structured finance security. In some sectors, it's not very heavily, there's not a strong role for a model.
Which sectors?
Oh. I haven't been involved in rating. I've been in committees 10, 15 years ago, and you know, I was thinking when I used to attend committees for auto loan-backed securitizations, you know, it was not a heavily model-driven analysis. In all committees where there are models used, there's also a judgment used. The models, to the extent they're used, they have different elements of analysis. There's elements of the collateral pool and thinking about the risk distribution of performance of the collateral pool. There's an analysis of the structure and how cash flows will you know, work their way through their structure and go to different security holders. And then there may be an overall views of the governance of the transaction and factors that are frankly outside of these modeling elements. In different sectors, you know, the analysis will vary. Multiple approaches may be taken and may change over time.
Do you have any understanding, like, what kind of historical data is used when coming up with the ratings for, say, RMBS or CEOs that has been collected? Is there a particular data source you're looking at? And is it loan-level data that is used or versus pool-level data that's been historically been used?
It varies a lot.
Varies a lot within the RMBS and CEOs, or just across
at all asset classes. It's kind of akin to what we have in the corporate area. We usually, you know, will evaluate all information that we can get our hands on that we have available to us. And that may differ from one corporation to another, and we'll form a view based on what we have available, assuming we have enough to form a view. So it really varies. So there's no unique standard. You know, this is what we used in this. I mean, you'd have to check at each person. In each case, I mean, one thing keep in mind that at least most people's attention is highly focused on investment grade securities, the higher rated securities, and the higher rated securities are trying to, give an indication of relative risk of very rare events, right? The events you're trying to identify may have historical will probably have historical data that's relevant across many transactions that you may have had. You know, there were in any given year, you might have 50 corporate defaults, or you might have, you know, 10 highly rated auto transactions or real estate transactions that experience losses due to factors that are specific to that particular pool. So you can analyze that data and trying to zero in on, you know, what will help me predict whether I get this really unusual loss relative to the rest of the asset class. One can explore data for that to, you know, get at the issue that that was at the core of what happened in real estate markets in the U.S. The interesting data to analyze, and I've recently seen, are things like the 400 years of history in the U.K. real estate market. I hadn't thought to look at that, and I don't know if my colleagues had looked at that, but I found an interesting Bank of England study of that, that there were episodes, and it's about 200 years, I think, in the U.K. real estate market, 500 years of data of the U.K. stock market. And so there's a lot of discussion about what data was available, but what was used. But I think in thinking about what the real issue here is, you have to say, well, what was the part that was not anticipated in the market generally and by most market participants, and not anticipated by our ratings? And that was that there would be this seizure in the real estate market of this magnitude, occurring with this speed, that I said is, you know, unprecedented. Maybe if you look at the UK 200-year history and you thought it was relevant, you might see something of interest there. But so, you know, what data was studied and looked at? I'm not sure. It's really to have the appropriate data for. It's not clear what the appropriate data is. With hindsight, I might say we should look at all real estate markets globally over hundreds of years to the extent that data exists. But then you have to take a second view of, you know, how relevant is that data to our particular market.
I think you had mentioned default correlation, mm-hmm. and its role in the RMBS or the ratings in general, mm-hmm. and that your group was looking at that in particular. What issues were you looking at in regards to default correlation? The fact that the assumptions evolved over time, or were they incorrect post-mortgage crisis, and then you realized that you go back, that what were the, and unpack a bit what the default correlation assumptions were, and why were they not amended to take into account potential house price depreciation as we have?
I guess I need you to repeat the question in a more specific way. I mean, the word correlation has many, many applications. Default correlation, it comes up in everything one might think about. So could you be more specific?
Oh, could you define then for me what is a default correlation? Or I know there's asset correlation, there's default correlation. Those are the main ones that I'm familiar with. Could you define?
Well, a default correlation is a view on how often two things default, or multiple things default at the same time. An asset correlation is used with corporates, can be used in structured finance as well, but to think about not whether there's a default experienced or not, but whether the total value of the corporate companies are rising and falling together, like the value of their equity and their debt together. So it's co-movements in some underlying driver performance value in...
Was your group able to actually look at the assumptions underlying a lot of the default correlations that are underpinning these models or methodologies?
my group didn't analyze default or asset correlations until, and we did get involved in a process of reviewing some changes in asset correlation assumptions in probably 2008. So I just wasn't sure what, when you were saying my group, that would be the first time I think I was involved.
Do you know who would look at those particular issues? If you can name people that were responsible for
well, there are some explicit assumptions of asset correlations in some CDO models. I don't know if default correlations are used anywhere. Whoever was working on CDO methodologies would be.
You don't have any names of anyone in particular?
Well, I mean, the entire group would be thinking about it. Whoever develops methodologies, it would change over time. People.
I'm not intentional, but with respect to, just because you had an overview, you step back a little bit and look at the methodologies a bit. Were you ever aware of any instances where issuers were trying to game the whole system, the rating system, either by way of barbelling, thin filing? Was that something?
What was the last one? Barbelling or what?
Thin filing.
Thin filing?
Was when you have a short credit history and to increase your FICO score. Have a high FICO score.
No. The term barbelling, as I understand it, is when a collateral pool consists of credits that have maybe two or possibly more, I suppose, but a simple barbell would have two very different sets of characteristics. So it would be pool A, and it's one pool, but there it has two components, one that might be a high FICO score and one that might be a low FICO score. And based on a recent congressional hearing where I heard the topic frankly discussed for the first time last week, I think there was a concern implied by the questioning, and I don't know if this is what you're concerned about, whether Moody's had information about the distribution of FICO scores in a mortgage-backed security, or simply knew the average FICO score in mortgage-backed in the collateral underlying a mortgage-backed security. And my understanding, we've always had, at least generally had, information about the distribution of FICO scores. So, in that sense, I wouldn't be concerned about barbelling. There was actually a paper, a methodology change we developed in the CDO, corporate CDO business in the late 80s, in which our methodology was focused on the average average credit risk of the underlying corporate collateral, and we realized that the distribution around the average was important, and we, were very focused on this. We were focused on this issue, and we developed a whole methodology approach about dealing with it. And there was no information; it was just a matter of, different collateral characteristics have certain imply certain risk, and we do our best to try to understand how it affects the risk of the overall transaction.
I know that you weren't aware of the benchmark approach, but are you more familiar with the M3 approach to our BS rating? The M3 model?
I'm familiar with our current model that we use, is M3. I can speak to what we currently use.
So you can't go back to, say, around 2003 earlier?
No.
So can you speak to what you currently have then? The M3 model that is now, the inputs and outputs of the model?
Well, the inputs are information about the loans in the collateral pool, and there are other inputs that are not specific to particular securitization. They're just kind of our macroeconomic views as well. And so the information about the collateral pool, information about the macroeconomic outputs, and you get a model-based view on the distribution of probability distribution of different levels of default in the collateral pool and early prepayments and loss severities on individual loans.
And so the outputs that are produced, I understand, is the expected loss, and then the other was the loss severity then, if I would say those are the outputs?
Well, no, the outputs is a probability distribution of many possible outcomes for the number of defaults that will be experienced in the mortgage pool, the amount of timing of prepayments, and the loss severities on individual defaults in the mortgage pool. So these are entire distributions. And with a distribution, you can calculate expected. But expected plays a relatively modest role in, well, I wouldn't say that. No, it's a component of our analysis. But the entirety of the distribution is something we, you know, consider.
I just want to understand, in terms of these two outputs then, how much of this is, like I would say, like, break it down by percentage, is used actually to establish the actual rating? It's like 70% of it used for this empirical aspect of these two outputs, and then how much of it is more of a qualitative assessment of what the rating should be?
We've only rated, I think, two transactions. I'm aware of two transactions we rated this year. The first one, I don't remember the name of it. I could guess a name, but you know, we could get it for you because we published a report on it. Three different approaches were taken to and explained in the our report to coming up with our view on the ratings for the different tranches. I think there may have only been one tranche, I'm not sure. But three different approaches were discussed, and in that particular transaction, it was mentioned that the primary weight was on one of the three that wasn't M3. We've very recently published another transaction that you know, discusses the basis of the ratings, and most of the discussion I don't think it's a meaningful statement to say what was the percentage or something. That's not really a meaningful statement. It just so happens that one publication, I think, and they give some reason, and I don't remember why, but in this subsequent publication there were many other factors that get a lot of attention in the write-up of the in the representations and warranties and the process for reviewing adherence to those representation and warranties. As mentioned, the general characteristics of the collateral is discussed in great extent.
And the underwriting standards, I presume, would also.
Well, it's in people use the term underwriting standards as if it's something distinct from the characteristics of the collateral. I view it as, I mean, it's the characteristics of the collateral.
I know you, sorry to interrupt, you had mentioned that there was a deterioration in the underwriting standards, and which was quite alarming. And did did Moody's do anything to really make adjustments to the methodology or how the rating is finally calculated to reflect that deterioration in underwriting standards?
Well, that's what I was saying. The deterioration in the underwriting standards is, you know, was evident in the observed characteristics of the collateral. And the framework that was used to rate the transactions, you know, had natural adjustments in it. Simplest case, you mentioned FICO score. A lower FICO score if a whole pool had lower FICO scores, it would require more enhancement to get to different rating levels in a transaction or different LTV loan-to-value ratios similarly. So the observed characteristics of the pools were changing. The methodology incorporated our views on what those different characteristics meant for future performance.
The M3, this model, it extends now to subprime loans. It rates, ceases to rate subprime loans as well.
Well, I don't know if we rate any new securitizations or so on so in subprime, but we have a model that also goes by the name of M3 that can be used and is used in thinking about surveillance of subprime securitizations. So we're using it as part of our ratings process.
And just so the record, Sharon Ellis is clear, I think you clarify, but of course Moody's doesn't actually rate the loan.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
So, was there ever... a discussion about the possibility of housing prices would perform very differently than they had in the past for prior downturns within your policy research group?
Prior to 2008 or 2007? No. Yes. My group, no.
You never examined the housing market?
No, it wasn't part, as I said, the mandate of my research group didn't include providing perspectives on securitization, collateral, or mortgage markets. We weren't part of that world.
Were you aware of anything regarding origination factors that were used in assessing a rating?
You're talking about my group again. My group, I wasn't involved
in
security.
General, not specific to your group, but in general.
Oh, but you said, was I aware?
Sorry, in general. The use of origination factors to rate.
Was Moody's? I know they consider the originator in there. They always considered their originators in the transaction. But my knowledge in this area doesn't really have much depth about the history of that that analysis.
So. Do you know who actually worked on the models themselves? Are you aware of the individuals that actually worked on the more recent version of the model, which you said was M3?
People currently working on M3, which is our residential mortgage model for the U.S.? Yes, I know the individuals.
Can you provide me with the names?
Roger Stein is head of a group that has responsibility for that development of that model, and the people that report to him would be the individuals involved.
Can you speak to how CDOs are rated? and the various models in any way, various models that have been used to rate CEOs?
I have a general understanding, yeah.
Do you know anything regarding the binomial expansion technique? Can you just describe what it is?
Yeah. The tool called the binomial expansion technique, or BAT, the objective of that tool is to, it's very stylized analysis. It's meant to give a view of, well, if I have a bunch of corporate, well, typically corporate obligations, whether corporate loans or corporate bonds, and I want to describe the probability distribution of experiencing different numbers of defaults over time. I think the window might be a 5-year or 10-year period, I forget which, but over time, out of, say, 100 corporate obligations, what's the likelihood I would experience no defaults over that period? 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 100, and have a probability associated with each one of those outcomes. And what the model does is say, well, we have an indicator of credit risk for each individual obligation, as summarized by the rating that we have on that individual obligation, plus we may give consideration to some other factors as well, such as the outlook or watch list status of that obligation. But we have an indication of individual credit risk, and therefore you could add, you know, it's a fairly straightforward answer, easy to answer the question if you accept those individual estimates of risk on the underlying bonds. You could say, well, what's my expected number of defaults? So if each one has a 10% chance of defaulting over a 10-year period, and you have 100 of them, the expected number of defaults will turn out to be 10. But how do you figure out the rest of the distribution? What's the probability of 0, 1, and so on? If you thought they were all independent, you'd get what's a very specific distribution around 10 would be the center, and you'd get a little distribution around it. But if you thought there were sources of joint default experience, things that cause things to happen together, it was broadly speaking correlation, you would get a different shape distribution. And the binomial expansion technique is a method of helping you think through about how different asset, different collateral pools, more pools of corporate bonds, would be more or less likely to have distributions that were spread out broadly away from that average, or were tightly distributed around the average. And the considerations would include concentrations in industry, and we also consider whether the individual bonds are large or small. We ultimately consider about the correlation of losses. So if you have large bonds, a few large bonds, they give you a lot more correlation risk. Some small bonds, if they're all equal sized, there's less correlation. And then lastly, there are factors that represent kind of the general uncertainty that is shared by all corporations together, which is, you know, are we likely to experience lots of defaults independent of whether they're in the same industry or different industries? And there's a factor that represents kind of that overall macroeconomic risk.
I think someone mentioned that there is a diversity score that is used.
Yeah, the diversity score tries to, it does provide a summary a measure of the concentrations or lack of concentration across industries, and concentration in the size. Again, very lumpy exposures, you know, a few very large and a few very small will give you potentially more lumpy outcomes. So the diversity, more diversity is better in the sense that there's less, you're less likely to have very, very bad outcomes and more likely to be near the mean. And more diversity you can achieve by distributing collateral across more industries and having more equal-sized collateral for a given number of collateral. It's better, in terms of a risk perspective, to have them more equal-sized. And that's what the diversity score measures.
I think someone also mentioned at some point they adopted an alternative diversity score. Is that true? Or what are they referring to when they're describing alternative diversity score?
I don't know.
Do you know when around the time BET was adopted?
Not sure. Sometime in the 90s, I think, but I'm not sure. But when I say adopted, I mean, I'm sure, you know, they're probably... some changes over time too. So, I mean.
Also, I think they moved from BET to correlated binomial method. And can you speak to how it improves the BET model, or what the differences were?
I'm not sure where the benefits of the correlated binomial model came from. I think it largely, and you should check with someone else to make sure. I think it largely produces similar results in the analytics for. Corporate, for the traditional corporate CDOs, but I believe it had more flexibility to include other asset classes into the analysis as well, and I think it was a response to a need for a framework that was broader than just corporate collateral. But yet a desire to still have a consistent approach between what we were doing in corporate and non-corporate. And so I believe it was developed in order to retain the essence of what we were doing with the BET approach, but to have more flexibility in where we would apply it and still be consistent in our in the way we were approaching things in different asset classes.
Do you have an idea when that was adopted? Or who would have created it or helped?
I'm not sure, but I think someone named Gary Witt was involved. And I would guess around 2000, but give or take 3 years, I don't really... realize that's just giving you broadly.
I've also heard references to a Gaussian coupla approach to default correlation. Because you're an economist, could you break that down for me a bit and how to examine default correlation? What was this approach to
I would first take a step back. We can talk about lots of models,
right.
With a model, what you're trying to do is try to develop an approach so that when you look at a series of transactions, you look at them on a consistent basis. So you're not changing what you're doing all the time just because different people walked into the room and so on. But when typically, my experience has been in any organization I've been with that use models, including the Federal Reserve, is that the model is a tool in the analysis to achieve consistency, but sometimes the most critical element for key decisions being how much risk is in the tail of the distribution is something that the model is not really giving you your first time guidance on. That is in many ways a qualitative view that you take about what's the likelihood of some really extreme event. Because models, you have to be careful with models, because small changes in assumptions in models will give you very different unintended consequences in the tail. So if my expectation is that as we evolved different models in any sector, what was driving our views about criteria to reach the highest rating categories was driven by many considerations, including model outcomes. So I just from my perspective, when people start saying, well, what about this model, this model, this model, I want to bring people back to the ground to say, well, when we develop models, these are a tool for the analysis to try to rate across transactions. But if you're trying to think of how much enhancement is normally required for a typical transaction of corporate collateral, that's not really produced by the model. That's something we take a view on as a firm, and we develop a model we think about the parameters. You know, it's kind of an iterative back and forth thinking about what models say. But to be clear, there's a lot of considerations into the average level of criteria, and the model is a tool that kind of summarizes your conclusions you've made and institutionalizes them on a consistent basis across transactions.
So then I guess you wouldn't have any comment as to whether, like, the correlation assumptions for the Gaussian, like the Gaussian Coppola approach was, like, lower than the correlation assumption of the BET approach, or how did they compare?
Well, my understanding is that they produce similar outcomes, and again, any specific assumption in a model is evaluating the assumption of the model is outside of thinking about the broader context of the model, and the overall output of the model can be misplaced. You want to take an overall view of, well, what is this modeling tool producing in terms of criteria that typically prevail, and do the criteria make sense? Whether a specific parameter in the model is the best possible parameter, or there can be difference of opinion about a specific parameter, can often be distractive, because there can be 100 other things with the model that you may have different views on, and so on. So any one parameter of the model could affect the outcome, but you really have to have confidence. Where you really need confidence is the average output of the model, not the specific any one parameter going in the model. So you asked, but you asked specifically about differences in the correlation assumption between BET and some later vintage model that may have been used. The BET model did not have a correlation parameter explicit in it, but the two models achieved similar criteria. So in that sense, they shared, implicitly in some perfect, if there is some ideal model that has a true correlation parameter, I would imagine in that ideal space that doesn't exist, they shared a similar correlation assumption.
How would you describe why structured finance ratings perform so poorly as compared to for other products?
Well, one of the things my group does is track the performance of the ratings and the realized default and loss experience associated with different rating categories. And so we have complete data from 1993, but we have broad knowledge of the performance of our ratings back through around 85, because we know there were virtually no defaults in that earlier experience or limited number, we know something. So we have a fair amount of knowledge about the 25-year history of this market. And so prior to the crisis, structured finance ratings had broadly performed in line with our other ratings. And then, since the onset of the crisis, mortgage-related securities, anything kind of touching that in the U.S., have experienced much higher loss rates than we would have expected, than we did expect. And the reason was, in hindsight, that housing prices fell much further than we anticipated they could fall, but more importantly, at a much more rapid speed. And the withdrawal of refinancing opportunities, went to a sudden stop that we didn't anticipate either. So those were the reasons.
How much was the cushion that was given, in general, for housing price drop? What was, was there a certain range that there was expectation?
Right. Well, for housing prices, I don't think we didn't specifically have a cushion for housing prices. What we have is cushion for individual rating levels in individual transactions. They each have a certain cushion in the sense that a certain number of mortgages or fraction of mortgages could default and experience loss severities on individual mortgages before losses would accumulate to a level that would actually impact investors' cash earned on those securities. So each mortgage-backed security had a certain level of protection against collateral pool losses. And collateral pool losses or mortgage defaults and losses could come about for a variety of reasons, being home price declines being a contributing factor, clearly unemployment or many defaults in mortgages occur because of family circumstances, a variety of types. So there are many reasons why defaults do occur. And in individual transactions, as I said, we have a long history of rating mortgage-backed securities, and some of them experience defaults. And for many of these other factors, not home prices is necessarily the driving factor. So what's most relevant for the analysis was how much was the overall level of support. And the overall level of support varied very much depending on what type of mortgages were in the pool. So if they were mortgages that were viewed as inherently very risky, it had more support than one that we thought the mortgages would be much less likely to experience losses.
The issue of low doc and no doc, how did they incorporate, were they incorporated in the methodology to count for low doc and no doc loans? What adjustments were made around when, if at all, if there was any discussion for the Moody's?
I briefly gone back and read our publications. I wasn't particularly involved, but I just was curious and went back and read them. I think we had always had adjustments for the quality of the information provided on individual loans in viewing a low doc loan is riskier than a full doc loan.
Do you have any idea how far back that goes?
I just assume. I don't know. I don't recall there being some major change. I mean, this is not something that would have been. I don't know.
To shift gears a bit, do you know? I'm not sure if you are involved in this aspect of ratings issues, but did analysts get involved in any way in setting ratings and also negotiate fees with issuers?
I don't believe analysts had any fee discussions with issuers
at all. Do you think that the competition for business, in your assessment, lead to RAs being lead writing agencies being lax in their ratings?
I have no reason to believe that.
Do you think that the issuers or underwriters negotiated with or pressure rating agencies to give more favorable ratings or credit enhancements?
Everybody who deals with the market tries to curry influence with us on every side of everything we do. So, I mean, I don't know anything specific about anything that you're referring to, but everyone tries to, you know, influence what we do, and that's what our business is to provide independence. And it's the fact that more people care about what we do comes from the fact that we don't react to that influence, and we provide an independent opinion.
Maybe you can speak to this, but do you think that there is any did Moody's or S&P or Fitch collude in any way to set prices or rating standards?
Not aware of any conversations among rating agencies on almost any topic, certainly not on collusion of pricing or standards.
We don't
talk with our competition, I mean, other than how, you know, if we see them at a conference panel, we say, how do you do, my name is so-and-so, and I think that's about the extent of our conversations.
I don't know if you want to take a break now, or...
I think we're on time.
It's a good break.
Yes,
it's 12:25. I'm going to pause the recorder.